Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, August 27, 2011. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. And our topic we've headlined for today is why NAWAPA, the North American Water and Power Alliance, is the only viable solution. I'll let you think of the scope of the crisis that refers to. But in particular, we are very glad to have two people from the Western, Midwestern and Western states to give us firsthand reports on different aspects of the situation. We headlined it, especially in the huge Missouri-Mississippi Valley watershed system, in those basins, but at large. So first I'm going to go to Minnesota. Speaking with us from southern Minnesota is Andy Olson. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, Marcia.
And Andy, you'll hear more throughout the show. Andy's farming now. I think, Andy, you've been a farmer all your life and maybe generations before there, right?
Yes.
And as I say, we'll get more to Andy's tremendous knowledge, but he's a fighter for what the kinds of things we need. And we're welcoming from Arizona, Wayne Voltz. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Marcia.
And I'll say right off the bat that Wayne spent his summer, for certain reasons, up in Montana, where a great deal of the Missouri River rises. He'll be talking about that, as well as he's speaking to us from a ferocious drought zone of our planet in Arizona. But I'll just say this today by way of introduction. We're here in the studios. We still have electricity. We're in west of Washington, D.C., and the Delmarva Peninsula and the Chesapeake Bay and the Mid-Atlantic states are going to be hit by Hurricane Irene's track in some hours, sometime tonight. And this question of disaster, which the men on the show are going to say more about, but our planet is very hyperactive right now in the way of tectonics, in the way of weather, in the way of volcanic activity, and we know that the eastern states had a very rare occurrence, an earthquake, in the last 10 days. So there's an expression of natural law here where it defines the crisis we have because we, as human beings, with creativity, with the potential for discovery, should be doing the kinds of things that protect human beings and protect the potential for creativity in the future instead of just being subjects to anything happening as if there's nothing you can do about it. Now, this just underscores the point that we have someone in office, in the highest office of our country, in president, namely Barack Obama, who's been functioning as just a patsy for those organized forces over the centuries, best called, you could call them the neo-British Empire, but kind of special financial interests centered in London and internationally that have said some people are born better than others. You can't do anything. Don't think you can do anything about nature. Don't. You're not human. You're just like any old animal. And as a matter of fact, you know, in the last 24 hours, President Obama says we can't. There's nothing we can do about Mother Nature. That's a quote from something. He's back in Washington, D.C., not to look bad as the hurricane hits. But the problem is we could be having a sane policy response to disasters. The vast flooding earlier this year in the lower Mississippi, the Ohio Valley, and the continued flooding in the Missouri system. We could be doing something about this, Hurricane Irene, but we are not. We have tremendous volunteerism and heroics, which is good. The Salvation Army gave a special report today, and the Red Cross in Washington. And again, this points up the fact that our federal government isn't doing what the legacy of the American system would be having it to do, go to the max with Army Corps of Engineers types approach to defend against floods and potential earthquakes and so forth. The Salvation Army said, you know, we're still busy because Hurricane Irene hit the Caribbean islands 4 days ago. And as of this morning, 800,000 people in those islands still don't have electricity. So While the Weather Channel may give you some useful information from the National Weather Service and so forth about Hurricane Irene or other situations, look at the whole globe. We have to be making a shift away from you can't do anything. This, you just have to keep bailing out bankrupt banks, while those are the privileged elite neo-British Empire banks, while we see whole nations and peoples suffering more. Look at Africa, with 12 million people in need of food. None of this need happen. None of this is natural. It's due to this unnatural continuation and tolerance of this kind of dead monitor system. What we need is a gateway to a radical shift, and that's why, as everyone who's listening, for whatever time you may know, we need to reinstate what we did in the 1930s, called the Glass-Steagall Act, at that time, to cut the speculation and inflation and destruction, create conditions for credit, back up what we need, and go ahead with developing projects, especially the continental scale priority ones like this North American Water and Power Alliance, which we're going to discuss. Now, let me just say this, and then we'll turn to our firsthand reports. Earlier this week, on the weekly report that Mr. LaRouche does with colleagues on LaRouche Political Action Committee website, LaRouchePAC.com, you'll find on, I think it was Wednesday, August 24th, in their discussion, Mr. LaRouche laid out seven actions, beginning with get Obama, resign him from office, I'll just put it that way, reinstate Glass-Steagall. By the way, Congress is coming back. They've been a bunch of unspeakables as a group, but there are over 33 and another 20, I think, promised signatures on the Glass-Steagall Act reintroduction bill called House of Representatives 1489. But get that in. Make this all happen. How much more in the way of disasters and proof does anyone need? It's a matter of guts now. And these seven actions that Mr. LaRouche laid out are now being backed up for your friends, your neighbors, on video explanations on LaRouchePAC.com on their daily video features. So I'm not going to, this isn't a catechism. I'm not going to say number one, I just described it. Move Obama out and get Glass-Steagall in and go for it. But the other nature, the other types of things we need to do without a list is make way for credits for emergency measures for counties, cities, and states so the governments keep functioning, the security forces, the health care, the sanitation, the ag extension, the good kind, and so forth. We need to launch this North American Water and Power Alliance and other kinds of things, fixing decrepit bridges and reassembling the coastline, doing various infrastructure projects, collaborate with nations abroad. This ends up being, especially going back into space, talk about monitoring for weather patterns and giving people adequate notice for taking cover and protection and going to safety. We need to have the science driver effect implied in all of that by going for high-tech construction methods, for high-tech monitoring of our planet methods, for high-skill education and experience. So by way of that introduction of the fact we can do this, and now I just really, Obama's a goner, and you could say it's not that politically he's got, or excuse me, psychologically he has the makeup to even do a Nixon and say I now resign, or friends of Nixon encouraged him to do that. But we're in that kind of phase shift period now where that's what you can expect to be done, because this man can't do anything right. He couldn't before, but people didn't listen to LaRouche and don't want to hear it, maybe, because Lyndon LaRouche said this in April 2009. You're dealing with a dysfunctional personality of compulsive need for attention in the President Obama. So, but now it's clear this guy's in the way. And so what I want to do something now is begin with the crisis we have on our hands to take advantage, Andy and Wayne, of your personal experience in the sense of if you would provide a description of Andy, if we could start with you, it doesn't mean it has to be out your front door. I do hope your fields were not flooded or very cold and delayed your planting or something. But can you just give me, from any of your vantage point, what the situation has been like this year in the way of what I know Wayne once called radical weather patterns?
Yes, it seems like we either have feast or famine here when it comes to the weather. We were very wet through the planting season and even through July, and then surprisingly, for the last month, we have not had much measurable rain, and so our yield potential is diminishing. The corn, I think, rain will not help it anymore, and the soybeans could fill if we could get some rain imminently. But it's varied throughout the Midwest. I sort of straddle. I'm on the Mississippi watershed, but just about 20 miles from me is the Missouri watershed, and the Missouri watershed has claimed a lot of the headlines up here, and justifiably so. The Missouri watershed and the snow melt, and coupled with above normal rainfall, has caused the Missouri to flood, and people have never seen it flood in most of the living out here in their lifetime, and it was a shock to people. And there's been a lot of politicking on the part of former Governor Janklow in South Dakota and so forth, and blaming the Corps for the flood.
The Corps of Engineers, uh-huh.
Yes, mm-hmm. And what I see, and I think there should be some more investigations about why the Corps didn't react sooner, and they have to be political, and they're having to deal with the Environmental Protection Agency, and they have declared the piping plover and the pallid sturgeon endangered species on the Missouri River. So they've been spending a lot of their effort making artificial sandbars over the years and going in the backwaters and trying to get habitat for this pallid sturgeon. And people say that there's plenty of sturgeon in the Missouri River. There's no reason for this. Well, there wasn't an effort to build up the levees.
Mm-hmm.
So when the water came, it washed out the habitats that they'd been spending millions on in just a matter of an hour or two. So now the money was not spent for the levees. The levees broke. It's a man-made catastrophe. But it's not being addressed in the media. The Interstate 29 parallels the Missouri River, and
it's in western Iowa, I believe, or
western
no?
Iowa, okay. Western Missouri.
Okay.
And where the levee in the Missouri-Iowa border broke, it shut off the interstate. It got out, so the traffic has been disrupted, and plus the farmers have experienced all kinds of difficulty. So it's like a new inland lake, and it's diminishing right now, but I think I-29, the last I heard, was still closed south of Omaha down past the Missouri border. So it's amazing that we've been able to do most anything as far as infrastructure and so forth, but in the last decades and years, we've just been horse collared by number of forces, Wall Street being one, but the environmentalist is the battering ram out here, mm-hmm. that is preventing us from putting in place the infrastructure that's necessary, not just in water, but in power generation. I mean, putting all this green windmills, they're plastering all these wind towers around in especially western Minnesota, southwestern Minnesota, along, it's called the Buffalo Ridge, and it's sad that we're doing this, and In South Dakota is basically there's I think six main stem dams that John Kennedy came out and he dedicated the Owyhee Dam at Pierce, South Dakota, and he called it one of the wonders of the world. It's still in place.
Mm-hmm.
The dam is held. It's a wonderful resource for the area as far as electricity. But at that time period and preceding that, it was FDR and his people. One of the individuals, his name was Leland Olds, and he fought for giant power as opposed to like small diesel generating and so forth. And giant power won out. And there is a coal-fired plant at Stanton, North Dakota, that's named after him.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is that over the years, the Environmental Protection Agency has imposed all these exhaust emissions and pollutants, and they're spending billions to try to mitigate this. And in the meantime, even some of these cooperative energy generations co-ops are putting in wind towers.
Oh.
Should never be doing that.
You mean the rural electric cooperatives or anywhere?
Yeah, Basin Electric would be an example, and then the that's the regional, the giant co-op, and then there's the other co-ops that are under them, and they're all promoting, running after credits for wind towers, and the government is pouring billions of dollars into this, and they're putting it on prime farmland.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a crime. It's a crime against our citizens.
Right. Well, Wayne, do you want to report from the you could say what you want about the drought, but the Missouri system and Montana from the same point of view?
Sure. Well, I spent the summer in south central Montana. I grew up there. My family's there. We still have farming and ranching operations in Carbon County, which is the south of Billings, on just north of the Yellowstone Park, essentially, in the Yellowstone watershed. I got there 1st of May, which was just pretty much the beginning of multiple cycles of heavy wet precipitation on our particular area there on in the Rock Creek Valley. At that point in time, every time there were 3 inches of rain in the valley, that was another 2 or 3 feet of snow pack in the mountains and up there to the Absorkey Wilderness, which encompasses the east and northern portion of the around the perimeter of the east side of the Yellowstone Park and north perimeter of the Yellowstone Park, which is where the Yellowstone River originates. And the Yellowstone basically receives all of the watersheds of the southeastern quadrant of Montana. So my observation, or initially right away, we were having unprecedented flooding events on our particular place there, which were inundating fields with water. There were multiple kind of factors involved, given certain types of maintenances that hadn't been done upstream from us. We were on a stream. One particular place is on a stream called Dry Creek. And because of the lack of maintenance upstream, there was a lot of deadfall, et cetera. And we were essentially flooded out. Some of the other things that occurred, now those cycles, there were several major cycles. I think we took on about 15 inches of rain and over the space of several weeks. And there were other areas north of us, east of us. One of the major problems that occurred was on the Musselshell River, north and west of Billings. And they had, they were describing that as a 500-year type event. Areas that had never been underwater before were underwater. Now, Montana, it's interesting to note, is just that area, that particular area, is coming out of a 10 or about a 15-year drought cycle. So this is, you know, these events were diametrically opposite of that. And there were many things that occurred. There were lives lost in the one particular case. A rancher lost about 200 head of cattle that had been run over off the precipice or a cliff because of trying to get away from the storm. There were ranchers, several people that I knew lost their lives or that I was aware of in our area to flood in the actual flood, whereas they were trying to save, a bridge or save livestock. One guy was struck by lightning. One guy drowned on his excavating machine. He was operating a track-mounted excavator trying to protect an area and was undermined. He drowned. So there were a lot of those types of things happen. But of course, in May, we have, that's the primary planting period, planting, fertilization, those crops in the ground type cycles. And of course, the fields being as wet as they were not plantable or fertilizable, so that is having some downstream impact. So there were the physical issues. I mean, there were the actual erosions and losses of bridges. So the one interesting thing to note was we had our reservoirs were full uncharacteristically, and probably had to do with, the historical drought cycle, trying to retain water as well as possible. But with the major events, there were, the overflows that had never been used or had seen that type amount of water go through were in use, and downstream flooding. So there were a lot of flooding events there. That were just unprecedented in nature. Major highways, I-90 was completely covered with water east of Billings in the Bighorn River area. And so they had shut that highway down. A lot of things that probably just went unreported, but the town of Roundup had probably some of the worst damage and had taken subsequent events where buildings were virtually underwater that had never had, in areas that had never had that problem before. So it was really a major cycle there. And, of course, that precipitated again, land not being planted or late planting. And when I left last week, the results were starting to show up. The spring wheat yields were looking like they were going to be down, late harvest type situations, that sort of thing, where we have there's always kind of the good news, bad news. The good news was that the dryland areas typically are unirrigated or dryland benefited. There were erosion situations, but there are higher yields of dryland hay crops and grain crops due to the waterfall. But in the areas of, in my area where I was at in the Rock Creek Valley near Red Lodge, there a lot of grow a lot of high quality grass hay, and of course that requires fertilizer. Typically, it is fertilized, and so the yields varied on that. I participated in putting up about 600 acres of grass hay. And my observation was that, you know, it was variable. In certain cases, it was reasonable, and a lot of it was, you know, the yields were off because of the inability, just the physical inability to get in the field and apply fertilizer. So, and then there are some other factors that I can talk about as we go along. There are some observations that I've made over the last couple of years that go to the ongoing deterioration or decline or the physical removing of productive land taking productive land out of production and converting it to other uses. And there are certain factors that typically are not taken into account, I think, that contribute to downstream flooding events, particularly the subdividing and subsequent relinquishing of water rights or water usage on, literally thousands of acres of land that were converted from had intrinsic value as productive farmland. And as a flood control mechanism, I think people don't maybe readily realize that, you know, productive agriculture, farmland in irrigated watersheds or specifically systems that had been designed and implemented in the Roosevelt programs. And in our case, there were those major ditch distribution systems that dissipate flood events or runoff events, which in our case, the norm there would be, you know, runoff from snowpack. In our case, this particular year, we had snowpacks in excess, you know, there in our watershed there in the Beartooth Absorkey Wilderness. There were 200 to 250% of normal snowpack. And in western areas of western Montana, up to 300% of normal. So the concern that I had, was that we would have these rain events that were contributing to that snowpack, and then when we moved into the warmer season in June and July, that we would, and it was totally possible that we would have a major runoff event right behind, you know, the rain events that saturated the land, and that was looking like it could have been catastrophic. However, fortunately, it was cool enough that it moderated that, and we didn't have that effect. So the other factors that are involved, or even in a normal runoff event or a snowmelt event, you have when we had agricultural land in blocks of farms and ranches in our area there, the irrigation systems act as a distribution system for those events, and rightfully so. That's the idea, is to utilize that runoff. But it also dissipates the energies of that, whereas currently we have, my observation and a theory that I'm developing, which I think is valid, is in the last 25 years, and I just was starting to correlate that with the shift that has occurred in the shift from a productive economy to a financial economy, and has some correlations with the implementation of agricultural programs like the CRP specifically. where in the subdivision of land, there have been thousands of acres. Most of the area that I grew up in, I'd say somewhere in the neighborhood of 75% of productive farmland has been converted to what I would call recreational property. So what happens then is that, and I can see it from both sides. I grew up in agriculture and in farming and ranching, thought I was going to be a farmer. And because of a financial recession, we had to sell that. I had to get out of that. And I became a builder. I got involved with excavating. I worked in cleaning irrigation systems, building ditches and irrigation systems. So I kind of have a perspective. And then I subsequently became a land developer and a home builder. So I've been able to see it from both sides. And in our case there in the valley, in the Rock Creek Valley, and I'm sure you could just multiply what I'm describing. Well, I know you can, over just about, millions of acres of productive farmland that had an intrinsic value, have been converted over the last 25 or 30 years, much of it, especially in the aesthetic areas along the river valleys and streams, have been converted to recreational type properties. And typically what happens with that is that water rights are relinquished. So when a piece of land is subdivided and you have, a 40-acre parcels or 20 or 10-acre parcels, they no longer have an incremental water right to that. So people come and they want to raise their horses or whatever. They have to pump water out of the ground to do irrigation if they choose to do that at all. And what happens with land that's not irrigated in that area, it generally reverts to weeds, typically what we call cheatgrass, just a dry land, grass that starts to, weeds and grass that start to occupy dry land that's not irrigated. And given that the water right has been relinquished, it just generally dissipates. It goes back into the pool, so to speak, of water right. And if we can contemplate how that happens and how that might contribute to downstream flooding or the dissipation of a flood event from a hydrological, a watershed type standpoint, you have situations where we've taken water that might have been distributed, across thousands of acres, remains in the river, and continues on downstream and doesn't get used at all. And if we looked at just that particular watershed in the Yellowstone River watersheds, that's a pretty common situation.
Well, let me ask here. You're describing kind of disorganization that took place. Instead of upgrading the water-land relationship and under judgment of educated, committed farmers, because people were, right, and they would be yet, but under this money system. Let me ask you, Andy, you may want to throw something in here from your geographical location. Minnesota's famous as the Land of Lakes, but since you're in the southern part, I think you're near the Des Moines River, which traverses Iowa and goes down in the Mississippi there.
Yes.
And over the period Wayne mentioned, the 1930s, and before and after, a lot of that was underlain by tiling at pipes, I think it's called. In other words, drainage improvements were made. Farmers did all this upgrading. There were small upper stream dams besides the larger ones, like you mentioned, the Owyhee. And that's been underfunded like crazy during the last 50 years. Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, the Soil Conservation Service was probably one of the most beneficial agencies that agriculture experienced. In my area, they would
That was 1935, I think it was set up under FDR, Henry
yes.
Wallace.
Mm-hmm. And they would cost share on waterway construction instead of just an eroded ravine, and then drain tile and so forth. And ours is called the prairie pothole, a type of topography, and a lot of this was initially drained by county ditches and so forth, that some of them would be just drainage tile, and then it has acted to really dramatically increase the ability of the land to produce food. And this is still ongoing today, but the environmentalists, the Department of Natural Resources, has been favored with funding here. In fact, in Minnesota, just a couple years ago, they passed a legacy tax that, instead of going into infrastructure, it goes to the Department of Natural Resources to save the fish and the animals and the wildlife. And they are buying up properties, and they're outbidding farmers and have been outbidding farmers. And they're going in and breaking these drainage systems and thwarting the ability to drain the land. And then it reverts back to a slough or a shallow type of a swamp.
Mm-hmm.
And in another area of the Midwest, which I've observed, is along the Missouri River, the soils are called loess.
Oh yeah, loess, L-O-E-S-S. Uh-huh.
And that's windblown soil.
Right.
And it's a completely different than the glaciated, the prairie soils. But I remember driving through like Shenandoah, southwest Iowa, after a rain event 35, 40 years ago, and the erosion was just horrific. And I just wondered, why were they farming that area and exposing it to so much erosion? Well, what happened in the interim, in the last 40 years, and earlier too, I'm sure, is that there was the soil conservation would design these terraces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that they would follow the equipment could go in there, and the widths would be would facilitate agriculture production. And I drove through there this summer, and I talked to a farmer that farmed a few thousand acres, and he said he had 90 miles of terraces on his farm. Now this is man making the soil more productive. The terraces catch the rainfall and hold it there, and there's maybe a piping system that mitigates that water, and tremendous crops.
Mm-hmm.
You know that. I'm sure that those in the river bottom, which are really, the river bottoms are the most fertile soils in the country. But the river bottoms now are flooded out, and up here where the soil conservation, the FDR legacy, has done tremendous things for production. And, you know, we need more of this. We don't need to reverse and break some of these systems that have drained the land and were productive. And it is exasperating to watch what the preeminence that the Department of Natural Resources in my state has.
Mm-hmm.
And they're spending millions and millions of dollars that's really, it's wasting this, our resources on animals.
Right.
And the people, we're needing a lot of help here for people in the state that, you know, as you heard a few months ago, Minnesota had a shutdown, and it was a fight over raising taxes or austerity. Well, in this type of Wall Street bailout austerity type economy, austerity is always going to win out. It doesn't make any difference if it's the Democrats or the Republicans. And the DNR, they should have forgiven some of their largest of money back to the state, but no, they were never cut. So you can see that this environmental movement, if we do not get a handle on this and rein this in, piping plovers and pallid sturgeons in the Missouri, and all this crazy stuff of we're going to protect this insect or this lizard or whatever it is. So, FDR's legacy is still real out here, but the environmentalists that are trying to shut down power lines or building of power generation, nuclear power, that's an old story. But if this whole subject of the Missouri River flood, that the volume of water that came down through the Missouri, I happened to go through the Gavin's Point Dam area, the last stem dam on the Missouri, and in the Yankton, South Dakota area, and they had 165 cubic feet per second. Million. And it was the most tremendous water that, it was almost frightening to see it come through there. And, when you think about it, the Southwest, Texas and Kansas and that area, the NWAPA program has designs to bring some of this water through Canada and dump into Lake Superior or from the Missouri into the Minnesota River and then run it down the Mississippi. But and maybe Hal Cooper has done some work on this where you can divert the water from right directly from the Missouri and go southwest with it. I would think that there would be engineering that would be capable of doing this, and in a year like this, you could put that water to good, where now it's for destruction. And I really wonder if I'm pretty convinced that the way the Wall Street parasites have handled the resources in our country is that these areas will not get rebuilt. Joplin, Missouri, the tornado area, will not get rebuilt. Now, what's going to happen with Irene now? I mean, I don't know. They're worried about the earthquake and the Washington Monument, but that's not really going to help us at all. So there's priorities that we need to rein in this environmental nonsense and all people, most of them just think that this is crazy, but they cannot comprehend and organize to the point of understanding what this is and shut it down.
Well, that's, you've certainly raised again the point that I mentioned at the start, that when it comes to what's to do, because I think more and more people, either you or Wayne can say something about this, more and more people will agree right off the bat, yes, we need production, not cuts. How are we going to get production? Yes, we need to get rid of these. The LaRouche Political Action Committee website is going as soon as possible, 24 hours, by the way, on updates and expansions of here is what to do, here is how to put, here is more to back up what you're putting across with your friends, neighbors, counties, states, townships. And this, I mentioned seven action points, one of which absolutely is destroy this greeny stuff that got out of the cradle, unfortunately, and started to take over. And I just couldn't encourage everyone listening more. This is the end of the summer that was. This is the end of the fiscal year that was. And now we're at a break point. And I think we can have this, now I'm speaking personally, this is it. I think we can do it. I mean, the six congressional candidate leaders who are associated with the LaRouche Political Action Committee, they are going like gangbusters. People listening to this show on LaRouchePub.com know who they are. You're talking about Boston, New Jersey, Texas. It's like the six parts of the country, California and Washington State. But I definitely do what Andy just said. We're going to it's the parasites or us, right? Do you want, Wayne, do you want to say anything more about, you've been very involved with the basement research team at different times over the, since last August, over the fact it is, it's why we called this show, this is the only practical and the highest sense level thing to do, is to point out the kinds of principles you're talking about, land and water upgrade, and go for North American water and power lines. Do you want to say more about that?
Sure. Well, I think there's something that I was moving toward with my description of land that has gone out of production.
Okay.
And that is that we needed to, during this last 40 years, when we needed to be increasing the productive arable land in the United States, it was being diminished by multiple factors. In fact, there's a article that I wrote that goes into that whole subject and a lot of the statistics.
Let me just put that in there for everyone to know. Look on LaRouchePAC.com. It's also been published by EIR Online. So that'll be Wayne Voeltz, W-E-L-Z. It's on LaRouchePAC.com in March. But you can it doesn't go by date. You can find it on the North American Water and Power Alliance site. Go ahead, Wayne.
Well, the goal, one of the primary goals of NWAPA as an end result is to increase arable land, increase water supplies, and foster power supplies, et cetera, you know, increase in science technological applications to do that. But one of the chief goals of NWAPA is that it can literally double the amount of productive farmland or farmland that we can produce food and fiber on in the western half of the United States. The western states apparently are not nearly as developed as they could possibly be, and of course much of the reason for that can be attributed to environmentalism, environmental policies and environmentalism proper over the last 30 to 40 years. In fact, it's easily trackable. It'd take a lot more time to go into that. But the result, of course, is to provide a water supply for the development of the West and to also help to replenish water supplies and the Ogallala Aquifer as well as the Great Lakes region. Water for the development of oil production in North Dakota, eastern Montana, many, many reasons for using the WAPA. But on the way through, it provides a platform. I mean, we're building an economic platform to expand or develop the western United States. But on the way to that, we're providing a platform for economic recovery and scientific and technological development because of the sophistication of that project.
Yeah, the implications, what we would know about more mass greening instead of doing the opposite, right?
Well, actually, yeah, and if we had more time, we could probably talk. Andy was, I agree with Andy that the CRP and the Soils Conservation Program had good intentions and were initiated with the proper, intention. However, those programs kind of got hijacked in the mid-80s with the subsequent farm bills, in my opinion, or my observation, that continued and used as a tool to reduce production, take production out of farmland, convert it into, conservation easements and things of that nature. So we needed to, even with the implementation of all of that, or of that whole environmentalism viewpoint, we are at a critical, or at a critical juncture. I mean, our food supplies are down to almost nothing. We have a month or two's available supply. We rely on other countries for imports of foods. We just absolutely are at a point where we have to make a major shift, and there are the necessary preconditions for that. We have to essentially, do the things that you've described earlier. And the first thing that goes with that is we got to get rid of this president with his policies. And then Glass-Steagall will provide, with the implementation of Glass-Steagall, that will provide the money system to fund the construction of Nawaba, which, in my calculations and working with the basement team and going through all of the original documents and considerations, for about the price that we bailed out, for about $1 trillion, we could have Nawaba well down the road. In an extrapolation, we did those numbers. $1 trillion was our early estimate of what it might cost to build Nawaba today.
Yeah, it's really something. Wayne, let me ask you, turn to Andy for just a minute. We've got the time's flying, but we have another 7 minutes. On your raising, it just seems so cheap at the price, what you just said, Wayne, and I know you work, it's true, the bailouts have been unbelievable. And Andy, on this question Wayne's raised about the food supply, it is, I know we're getting a lot of reports from, just like, as you said, from Iowa, the corn from county to county. One county, no rain at all in the last 6 weeks or so. You've got a real hardcore shortage. You have all this corn going into biofuels under Obama. But also, in particular, you have the overlay of the bailout money going into plain old killer speculation on the Chicago Board of Trade and driving up the input costs so that farmers, it's impossible for them. And the other thing in the final minutes, you, along with the physical change of the actual landscape, you had a structural change in who's farming, like 30,000-acre farm operations in South Dakota or something. Would you make that clear for people?
Yes. The one of the major crises that we're going to be facing in the next generation is the loss of farmers. I mean, I never would have believed that they could have taken that out of the small dairymen and moved that into the mega dairies. But we're starting to see that, and we're experiencing that in our area. I know in California and the Southwest, that's been how they've operated. But Minnesota still has like 6,000 dairy farms, and a lot of those are the smaller farmers, and that's what's been the backbone of milk production. And the area that I'm most concerned about right now is animal agriculture. And, the Tysons and the Pilgrim's Pride and so forth are into the poultry and the layers and so forth. The part of agriculture that is benefiting from this inflation, and it's in a sense it's a mirage, is the grain producer. The prices that the inflation that we're experiencing in the Chicago Board of Trade arena is like I don't think I've experienced in my lifetime. Back in 1974 and the Russian
Great Grain Robbery, they called it at the time. They came in and bought a lot of grain, for those of you who suddenly overnight.
But this is even in more so. And what's magnifying the problem is that 40% of the corn is going into the gas tanks of Americans to burn, to power their cars. And the way this was set up is that they let farmers invest in these ethanol plants, so they've been the benefit of government subsidies. And so farmers have sort of adopted the idea that this green energy, that's great, but it's in the long run, this is a destructive force in our country. Inflation, the inputs have, we used to have a lot of this was controlled by cooperatives, but the cartels of the stripe of Cargill and so forth have gone into the fertilizer area and monopolized where the cooperatives were, and so potash would come from the Estevan, Saskatchewan area, and now that's Mosaic. That's a spinoff from Cargill. They bought up the farmland and the Senex fertilizer facilities, and so potash is up 29% from a year ago in price, and their production cost did not go up 29%. Mm-hmm. This is predatory. This is parasites again. Sulfur, which is more of a secondary mineral that farmers use, has gone up 32%. Nitrogen is, I don't know, that's all off the charts. And that's been taken almost out of the U.S., where it was primarily manufactured in the U.S., and now it's in, like in Trinidad, and it's the Middle East, and things have gotten so globalized that, you know, the small service co-ops that provide this kind of service to the farmers, they don't know. I mean, they have to have millions of dollars to finance this, and you know, the cartels, it's just predatory out here. You know, I just can't imagine how our food system has been degraded, and it's again, it's, I guess you can look to Wall Street and the City of London, and these people that are running these speculative markets, they're just gaming the system. They're just making money for their own selfish, you know, that as opposed to the bigger picture of destruction of this country. That's what this is all about. Just destroy America, and we'll do it through environmentalism and speculation, and then globalizing things. We'll shut down the mines. We'll shut down the manufacturing, and we can just, you can put chapter and verse on how America has been pulled down. I mean, just earlier talking about FDR and what he did. I mean, this wasn't just in Minnesota and Montana. This was throughout the country. The Soil Conservation Service was a tremendous impact on production, and we've had land-grant universities, but they've been defunded because of austerity, and we're just a shadow of what the land-grant universities were, and now they're just appendages for the cartels, the Monsanto. I mean, it's too bad we can't go into Monsanto. That's, you know, they took over the seed patent laws and got rid of those, and then now we've got this better idea from not Ford but Monsanto.
That's right, yeah.
and they've been having train wrecks with their so-called genetically modified BT insect corn rootworm and so forth, where this was supposed to control the corn rootworm. Now these extremely expensive seeds are not controlling the corn rootworm, the glyphosate, the Roundup, which is having negative effects. And
what about the price in the seed increase, too, could you say?
Oh, when I was first farming, it was like $25 a bushel for seed, and it was good quality seed, and it wasn't genetically modified. Now it's 300 and some, and it's going up. And then Monsanto, you know, they're saying, well, maybe our Roundup isn't working so good, but we have this Alicor. We're going to revive that lasso harness type herbicide, and we're going to call it Warrant, but it's only going to cost you about an arm and a leg to put it on. And
well, so, having them decide what kind of research we need instead of our land-grant colleges. You mentioned the system of agriculture research that gave us such things as Norman Borlaug at University of Minnesota in your state. He was from Iowa, right?
Yes.
So you need the real research. We can have biotechnology on behalf of mankind instead of on behalf of Monsanto money people.
Yeah, it's really sad what I could just weep what's been done to the land-grant system. And you know, we've got one plant pathologist at the University of Minnesota, and he's based up at the St. Paul campus. Well, we had plant pathologists at these experiment stations all over the state.
Right. You know, here's what, we've run out of time. We're going to have other shows on this. And Wayne, on the, I know the work that you're doing, and the other thing I'm going to tell people, though, this is, everything you just described, this is the break point, isn't it? And we are going to go, as we started the show, for... This is what we're describing is what we're going to overturn. And so we want everyone to do their all out, begin the next few hours. This disaster factor on the East Coast, this is very real, and I want everyone to be watching, if you haven't already, the weather series on LaRouchePac.com. Peter Martinson from the basement research team, whom Wayne knows, watch the last one in particular on the what's happening with the sun. This is reality. So I think we'll have to leave it there. I thank Wayne Volton, Andy Olson, and we'll schedule some more on just what you're talking about on the biology and so forth. So thank you for August 27th. This is 2011. Marcia Mary Baker signing off. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, yeah. Enjoyed it.